and welcome to the Shabby Shuffle. My name is Wally and you're listening to Radioactive International. In tonight's show, we're going to listen to one record. It's an album that was released in 1975 and features a recording from 1962 of Sylvia Plath reading her own poetry. It also features an interview that Sylvia Plath did with Peter Orr of the British Council. As I say, it was recorded in October, in fact at the end of October 1962, 3 days after her 30th birthday, and in fact it was less than 4 months before she took her own life in February 1963. The sleeve notes of the records say that October was probably the most important month in her life. She was newly separated from her husband, the poet Ted Hughes, and she experienced a rush of creative energy that must have been nearly overwhelming. It produced at least 26 poems in October, which became the core manuscript for her book Ariel. It says she rose to work at 4 each morning before her 2 babies were up. It was, she wrote to another poet, like writing inside God's intestine. She was so perfectly aware of the extraordinary achievement these poems represent. In a letter to her mother in the middle of the month, she said, "I'm a genius of a writer. I have it in me. I'm writing the best poems of my life. They will make my name." And with her unusual intuition, she correctly predicted that they should win a Pulitzer Prize, which the sleeve notes say which she didn't do, but in fact, posthumously, she did in 1982 win a Pulitzer Prize for collected poems. So the recording, the album has the poems first, and then the interview with Peter Orr. But I'm actually going to play them in reverse. So we'll listen to the interview first, and then listen to Sylvia reading her own poems. And just from my point of view, I first came across Sylvia Plath. I was introduced to him by a pen friend I had in my early 20s, Angie, and we wrote together for quite a few years, and we traded books and records and things like that. Angie sent me a book of Sylvia Plath's poems, so that was the first time I came across her. But I think it's always interesting to hear an author or a writer reading their own work. I mean, even in music, I like to hear a singer sing his own songs. I always think it's a little more potent. So these recordings, I think, are very interesting. So it is great to hear the author's voice and the poems. So it's just slightly less than an hour. We'll have a little bit of music at the end, but let's listen to the poems now, and I hope you enjoy them. I'll be back next week with a more conventional program with some music. Okay. Talk to you then.
Sylvia, what started you writing poetry?
I don't know what started me. I just wrote it from the time I was quite small. I guess I liked nursery rhymes, and I guess I thought I could sort of do the same thing. I wrote my first poem, my first published poem, when I was 8 and a half. It came out in the Boston Traveler. And from then on, I suppose I've been a bit of a professional.
What sort of things did you write about when you began writing poetry?
Nature, I think. Birds, bees, spring, fall, all those subjects which are absolute gifts to the person who doesn't have, you know, sort of any interior experiences to write about. I think that the coming of spring, the stars overhead, first snowfall and so on are gifts for a child, you know, a young poet.
Now, jumping the years, can you say, are there any themes which particularly attract you now as a poet, things that you feel you would like to write about?
Perhaps this is an American thing. I've been very excited by what I feel is the new breakthrough that came with, say, Robert Lowell's Life Studies, this intense breakthrough into very serious, very personal, emotional experience, which I feel has been partly taboo. Robert Lowell's poems about his experiences in a mental hospital, for example, interest me very much. These peculiar, private, and taboo subjects, I feel, have been explored in recent American poetry. I think particularly of the poetess Anne Sexton, who writes also about her experiences as a mother who's had a nervous breakdown, as an extremely emotional and feeling young woman. And her poems are wonderfully craftsmanlike poems, and yet they have a kind of emotional and psychological depth, which I think is something perhaps quite new, quite exciting.
Now, you as a poet, and as a person to straddle the Atlantic, if I can put it that way, being an American yourself.
That's a rather awkward position, but I'll accept it.
On which side does your weight fall, if I can pursue the metaphor?
Well, I think that as far as language goes, I'm an American. I'm afraid I'm an American. My accent's American. My way of talk is an American way of talk. I'm an old-fashioned American. That's probably one of the reasons why I'm in England now and why I always stay in England. I'm about 50 years behind as far as my preferences go. And I must say the poets that excite me most are the Americans. There are very few contemporary English poets that I admire.
Does this mean that you think contemporary English poetry is somehow behind the times when compared with America?
No, I think it's in a bit of a straitjacket, if I may say so. There was an essay by Alvarez, A. Alvarez, the British critic. His arguments about the dangerousness of gentility in England are very pertinent, very true. And I must say that I am not very genteel, and I feel that gentility has a stranglehold. The neatness, the wonderful tidiness, which is so evident everywhere in England, is perhaps more dangerous than it would appear on the surface.
But don't you think, too, that there's this business of English poets who are labouring under the whole weight of something which in block capitals is called English literature?
Yes, I couldn't agree more. I know when I was at Cambridge, this appeared to me. Young women would come up to me and say, how do you dare to write? How do you dare to publish a poem? Because of the criticism, the terrible criticism that falls upon one if one does publish. And the criticism is not of the poem as poem. I remember being appalled when someone criticized me for beginning just like John Donne, but not quite managing to finish like John Donne, and I felt the weight of English literature on me at that point. And I think the whole emphasis in England, in the university, on practical criticism, but not that so much as historical criticism, you know, knowing what period a line comes from. This is almost paralyzing. In America, at university, we read what? T.S. Eliot, Dylan Thomas, Yeats. That's where we began. Shakespeare floated in the background. I'm not sure I agree with this, but I think that for the young poet, the writing poet, it's not quite so frightening to go to university in America as it is in England for these reasons.
You say, Sylvia, that you consider yourself an American, but when we listen to a poem like Daddy, which talks about Dachau and Auschwitz and Mein Kampf,
the
impression that this is the sort of poem that a real American could not have written with the same feeling and grasp with which you have written it, because it doesn't mean so much. These names do not, I think, mean so much on the other side of the Atlantic, do they?
Well, now, you're talking to me as a general American. Well, in particular, my background is, may I say, German and Austrian. On one side, I'm a first-generation American. On one side, I'm a second-generation American. And so my concern, I must say, with concentration camps and so on, is uniquely intense. And then again, I'm rather a political person as well. So I suppose that's where part of it comes from.
And as a poet, do you have a great and a keen sense of the historic?
I'm not a historian, but I find myself being more and more fascinated by history. And now I find myself reading more and more about history. I'm very interested in Napoleon at the present. I'm very interested in battles, in wars, in Gallipoli, or, the First World War and so on. And I think that as I age, I'm becoming more and more historical. I certainly wasn't at all in my early 20s.
Do your poems tend now to come out of books rather than come out of your own life?
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that at all. I think my poems come immediately out of the sensuous and emotional experiences I have. But I must say I cannot sympathize with these cries from the heart that are informed by nothing except, you know, a needle or a knife or whatever it is. I believe that one should be able to control and manipulate experiences, even the most terrifying, like madness, being tortured, this sort of experience. And one should be able to manipulate these experiences with an informed and intelligent mind. I think that personal experience is very important, but certainly it shouldn't be a kind of shut box and sort of mirror-looking, narcissistic experience. I believe it should be relevant, and relevant to the larger things, the bigger things, such as Hiroshima and Dachau and so on.
So behind the primitive emotional reaction, there must be an intellectual discipline.
I feel that very strongly. Having been an academic, having been tempted by the invitation to stay on, to become a PhD, a professor and all that, one side of me certainly does respect all disciplines, as long as they don't ossify.
What about writers who've influenced you? Perhaps that's the wrong word to use. Have meant a lot to you?
There are very few. I find it hard to trace them, really. When I was at college, I was stunned and astounded by the moderns, by Dylan Thomas, by Yeats, by Auden even. At one point, I was absolutely wild for Auden, and everything I wrote was desperately Audenesque. Now I begin to go backwards. I begin to look to Blake, for example. And then, of course, it's presumptuous to say that one is influenced by someone like Shakespeare. One reads Shakespeare, and that's that.
Sylvia, one notices in reading your poems and in listening to your poems that there are two qualities which emerge very quickly and clearly. One is their lucidity, and I think these two qualities have something to do one with the other, their lucidity and the impact they make on reading. Now, do you consciously design your poems to be both lucid and to be effective when they're read aloud?
No, I don't. May I say this, that the ones I read are very recent, and I have found myself having to read them aloud to myself, saying them to myself. Now, this is something I didn't do. For example, my first book, The Colossus, I can't read any of the poems aloud now. I didn't write them to be read aloud. They, in fact, quite privately, bore me. Now, these ones that I have just read, the ones that are very recent, I've got to say them. I speak them to myself. And I think that this, in my own writing development, is quite a new thing with me. And whatever lucidity they may have comes from the fact that I say them to myself. I say them aloud.
Do you think this is an essential ingredient of a good poem, that it should be able to be read aloud effectively?
Well, I feel that. I do feel that now. And I feel that this development of recording poems, of speaking poems at readings, of having records of poets, I think this is a wonderful thing. I'm very excited by it. In a sense, there's a return, isn't there, to the old role of the poet, which was to speak to a group of people, to come across.
Or to sing to a group.
To sing to a group of people. Exactly, exactly.
Setting aside poetry for a moment, are there other things that you would like to write or that you have written?
Well, I shan't say I've become interested in prose. I always was interested in prose. As a teenager, I wrote short stories a lot, and I published short stories. And I always wanted to write the long short story. I wanted to write a novel. Now that I have attained, shall I say, a respectable age and have had experiences, I feel much more interested in prose, in the novel. I feel that in a novel, for example, you can get in toothbrushes and all the paraphernalia that one finds in daily life, and I find this more difficult in poetry. Poetry, I feel, is a tyrannical discipline. You've got to go so far, so fast, in such a small space that you've just got to burn away all the peripherals. And I miss them. I'm a woman. I like my little Lares and Penates. I like trivia. And I find that in a novel I can get more of life. Perhaps not such intense life, but certainly more of life. And so I've become very interested in novel writing as a result.
This is almost a Dr. Johnson sort of view, isn't it? What was it he said, that there are some things which are fit for inclusion in poetry and others which are not?
Well, of course, as a poet, I would say, poof, I would say everything should be able to come into a poem, but I can't put toothbrushes in a poem. I really can't.
Do you find yourself much in the company of other writers, of poets?
I much prefer doctors, midwives, lawyers, anything but writers. I think writers and artists are the most narcissistic people. I mustn't say this. I like many of them. In fact, a great many of my friends happen to be writers and artists. But I must say, what I admire most, or I certainly find myself looking toward, is the person who masters an area of practical experience and can teach me something. I mean, my local midwife has taught me how to keep bees. Well, she can't understand anything I write. And I find myself liking her, may I say, more than most poets. And among my friends, I find these people who know all about boats or know about a certain sport or know about how to cut somebody open and remove an organ. Well, I'm fascinated by this mastery of the practical. And I must say, I feel as a poet, one lives a bit on air. And I always like someone who can teach me something practical.
Is there anything else which you would rather have done than writing poetry? Because this is something, obviously, that takes up a great deal of one's daily life, if one's going to succeed at it. Do you ever have any lingering regrets that you didn't do something else?
Well, I think if I had done anything else, I would have liked to be a doctor. And this is the sort of polar opposition to being a writer, I suppose. My best friends, when I was young, were always doctors. I used to dress up in a white gauze helmet and go around and see babies born and cadavers cut open. Well, this fascinated me, but I never could bring myself to disciplining myself to the point where I could learn all the details that one has to learn to be a good doctor. This is the sort of opposition. Somebody who deals directly with human experience is able to cure, to mend, to help, this sort of thing. I suppose if I have any nostalgias, it's this, but I console myself because I know so many doctors, and I may say that I think perhaps I'm happier writing about doctors than I would have been being one.
But basically, this thing, the writing of poetry, is something which has been a great satisfaction to you in your life, is it?
Oh, satisfaction, yes. I don't think I could live without it. It's like, you know, water or bread or something absolutely essential to me. I find myself absolutely fulfilled when I have written a poem, when I'm writing one. Having written one, well, then you fall away very rapidly from having been a poet to becoming a sort of poet in rest, which isn't the same thing at all. But I think the actual experience of writing a poem is a magnificent one. The Rabbit Catcher. It was a place of force. The wind gagging my mouth with my own blown hair, tearing off my voice, and the sea blinding me with its lights, the lives of the dead unreeling in it, spreading like oil. I tasted the malignity of the gorse, its black spikes, the extreme unction of its yellow candle flowers. They had an efficiency, a great beauty, and were extravagant like torture. There was only one place to get to, simmering, perfumed, the paths narrowed into the hollow. And the snares almost effaced themselves, zeros shutting on nothing, set close like birth pangs. The absence of shrieks made a hole in the hot day, a vacancy. The glassy light was a clear wall, the thickets quiet. I felt a still business, an intent. I felt hands round a tea mug, dull, blunt, ringing the white china. How they awaited him, those little deaths. They waited like sweethearts. They excited him. And we, too, had a relationship. Tight wires between us, pegs too deep to uproot, and a mind like a ring, sliding shut on some quick thing, the constriction killing me also. Aerial. Stasis in darkness. Then the substanceless blue pour of tor and distances. God's lioness, how one we grow. Pivot of heels and knees. The furrow splits and passes. Sister to the brown arc of the neck I cannot catch. Nigger eye berries casting dark hooks. Black sweet blood mouthfuls. Shadows. Something else, hauls me through air, thighs, hair, flakes from my heels. White Godiva, iron peel, dead hands, dead stringencies. And now I foam to wheat, a glitter of seas. Poppies in October. Even the sun clouds this morning cannot manage such skirts, nor the woman in the ambulance whose red heart blooms through her coat so astoundingly. A gift, a love gift, utterly unasked for, by a sky palely and flamily igniting its carbon monoxides, by eyes dulled to a halt under bowlers. Oh, my God, what am I, that these late mouths should cry open in a forest of frost, in a dawn of cornflowers? The applicant. First, are you our sort of person? Do you wear a glass eye, false teeth, or a crutch, a brace or a hook, rubber breasts or a rubber crotch, stitches to show something's missing? No, no. Then how can we give you a thing? Stop crying. Open your hand. Empty? Empty. Here is a hand to fill it and willing to bring teacups and roll away headaches and do whatever you tell it. Will you marry it? It is guaranteed to thumb shut your eyes at the end and dissolve of sorrow. We make new stock from the salt. I notice you are stark naked. How about this suit? Black and stiff, but not a bad fit. Will you marry it? It is waterproof, shatterproof, proof against fire and bombs through the roof. Believe me, they'll bury you in it. Now your head, excuse me, is empty. I have the ticket for that. Come here, sweetie, out of the closet. Well, what do you think of that? Naked as paper to start, but in 25 years she'll be silver, in 50, gold. A living doll everywhere you look. It can sew, it can cook, it can talk. It works. There is nothing wrong with it. You have a hole, it's a poultice. You have an eye, it's an image. My boy, it's your last resort. Will you marry it? Marry it. Marry it. Lady Lazarus. I have done it again. 1 year in every 10 I manage it. A sort of walking miracle. My skin bright as a Nazi lampshade. My right foot a paperweight. My face a featureless fine Jew linen. Peel off the napkin, oh my enemy. Do I terrify? Yes, yes, Herr Professor, it is I. Can you deny the nose, the eye pits, the full set of teeth? The sour breath will vanish in a day. Soon, soon the flesh the grave cave ate will be at home on me, and I a smiling woman. I am only 30, and like the cat, I have 9 times to die. This is number 3. What a trash to annihilate each decade. What a million filaments. The peanut-crunching crowd shoves in to see them unwrap me hand and foot. The big strip tease. Gentlemen, ladies, these are my hands, my knees. I may be skin and bone. I may be Japanese. Nevertheless, I am the same identical woman. The first time it happened, I was 10. It was an accident. The second time I meant to last it out and not come back at all. I rocked shut as a seashell. They had to call and call and pick the worms off me like sticky pearls. Dying is an art, like everything else. I do it exceptionally well. I do it so it feels like hell. I do it so it feels real. I guess you could say I've a call. It's easy enough to do it in a cell. It's easy enough to do it and stay put. It's the theatrical comeback in broad day to the same place, the same face, the same brute, amused shout, a miracle that knocks me out. There is a charge for the eyeing of my scars. There is a charge for the hearing of my heart. It really goes. And there is a charge, a very large charge, for a word or a touch or a bit of blood or a piece of my hair or my clothes. So, so, Herr Doctor, so, Herr Enemy. I am your opus. I am your valuable. The pure gold baby that melts to a shriek. I turn and burn. Do not think I underestimate your great concern. Ash, ash, you poke and stir, flesh, bone. There is nothing there, a cake of soap, a wedding ring, a gold filling. Hear God, hear Lucifer, beware, beware. Out of the ash I rise with my red hair, and I eat men like air. A secret, how superior. You were blue and huge, a traffic policeman holding up one palm. A difference between us? I have one eye, you have two. The secret is stamped on you, faint, undulant watermark. Will it show in the black detector? Will it come out? Wavery, indelible, true, through the African giraffe in its Edeny greenery, the Moroccan hippopotamus. They stare from a square, stiff frill. They are for export, one a fool, the other a fool. A secret, an extra amber brandy finger, roosting and cooing, you, you, behind two eyes in which nothing is reflected but monkeys. A knife that can be taken out to pare nails, to lever the dirt. It won't hurt. An illegitimate baby, that big blue head. How it breathes in the bureau drawer. Is that lingerie, pet? It smells of salt cod. You had better stab a few cloves in an apple, make a sachet, or do away with the bastard, do away with it altogether. No, no, it is happy there. But it wants to get out. Look, look, it is wanting to crawl. My God, there goes the stopper. The cars in the Place de la Concorde. Watch out. Stampede, a stampede. Horns twirling and jungle gutturals. An exploded bottle of stout, slack foam in the lap. You stumble out, dwarf baby, the knife in your back. I feel weak. The secret is out. Cut. Cut. What a thrill. My thumb instead of an onion. The top quite gone, except for a sort of a hinge of skin, a flap like a hat, dead white. Then that red plush. Little pilgrim, the Indians axed your scalp. Your turkey wattle carpet rolls straight from the heart. I step on it, clutching my bottle of pink fizz. Celebration, this is. Out of a gap, a million soldiers run, redcoats, every one. Whose side are they on? Oh, my homunculus, I am ill. I have taken a pill to kill the thin, papery feeling. Oh, saboteur, kamikaze man, the stain on your gauze Ku Klux Klan babushka darkens and tarnishes. And when the bald pulp of your heart confronts its small mill of silence, how you jump, trepan veteran, dirty girl, thumb stump. Stopped dead. A squeal of brakes, or is it a birth cry? And here we are, hung out over the dead drop, Uncle, pants factory fatso, millionaire. And you out cold beside me in your chair. The wheels, two rubber grubs, bite their sweet tails. Is that Spain down there? Red and yellow, two passionate hot metals, writhing and sighing. What sort of a scenery is it? It isn't England, it isn't France, it isn't Ireland. It's violent. We're here on a visit. With a goddamn baby screaming off somewhere. There's always a bloody baby in the air. I'd call it a sunset, but who ever heard a sunset yowl like that? You are sunk in your seven chins, still as a ham. Who do you think I am, uncle, uncle? Sad Hamlet with a knife? Where do you stash your life? In your breast, in your vest, in your haunch, in your paunch, that snail frill of breath, that start of the heart. You see, I see a sort of a twig that might just hold me, but not you. You're too big. Is it a penny, a pearl, your soul, your soul? I'll carry it off like a rich, pretty girl. Simply open the door and step out of the car and live in Gibraltar on air, on air. Nick and the Candlestick. I am a miner. The light burns blue. Waxy stalagmites drip and thicken. Tears the earthen womb exudes from its dead boredom. Black bat airs wrap me. Raggy shawls, cold homicides. They weld to me like plums. Old cave of calcium, icicles, old echoer. Even the newts are white, those holy joes. And the fish. Christ, they're panes of ice, a vice of knives, a piranha religion drinking its first communion out of my live toes. The candle gulps and recovers its small altitude, its yellows hearten. Oh, love, how did you get here? Oh, embryo, remembering even in sleep your crossed position. The blood blooms clean in you, ruby. The pain you wake to is not yours. Love, love, I have hung our cave with roses, with soft rugs, the last of Victoriana. Let the stars plummet to their dark address. Let the mercuric atoms that cripple drip into the terrible well. You were the one solid the spaces lean on, envious. You were the baby in the barn. The brass atlas you inherited is hefting his milk pillar. He kneels, head bent, a panther head on a panther pelt, gnawing his forehead. Each incisor a wide, bright horn. The panther mane squirming, a million gold worms down his back. A bearded Greek. Under the gold bowl of his navel, where his phallus and ball should be a panther claw, I leave you the mystery. It is not the firmament that makes him look so sick, this philosopher. Maybe it's the panther jaw, the beastly lobotomy. The mirror floats us at one candle power. We smile and stare. That's you. That's me. Medusa. Off that land spit of stony mouth plugs, eyes rolled by white sticks, ears cupping the sea's incoherences, you house your unnerving head. God ball, lens of mercies. Your stooges plying their wild cells in my keel's shadow, pushing by like hearts. Red stigmata at the very center, riding the rip tide to the nearest point of departure, dragging their Jesus hair. Did I escape, I wonder? My mind winds to you, old barnacled umbilicus, Atlantic cable, keeping itself, it seems, in a state of miraculous repair. In any case, you are always there, tremulous breath at the end of my line, curve of water upleaping to my water rod, dazzling and grateful, touching and sucking. I didn't call you. I didn't call you at all. Nevertheless, nevertheless, you steamed to me over the sea. Fat and red, a placenta paralyzing the kicking lovers. Cobra light, squeezing the breath from the blood bells of the fuchsia. I could draw no breath, dead and moneless, overexposed like an X-ray. That martyr's smile, that loony pivot, that stellar jellyhead, and a million little suckers loving me. Who do you think you are? A communion wafer, blubbery Mary. I shall take no bite of your body, bottle in which I live, ghastly Vatican. I am sick to death of hot salt. Green as eunuchs, your wishes hiss at my sins. Off, off, Ely tentacle. There is nothing between us. Perda. Jade, stone of the side, the agonized side of a green Adam. I smile, cross-legged, enigmatical, shifting my clarities. So valuable, how the sun polishes this shoulder. And should the moon, my indefatigable cousin, rise with her cancerous pallors, dragging trees, little bushy polyps, little nets, my visibilities hide, I gleam like a mirror. At this facet, the bridegroom arrives, lord of the mirrors. It is himself he guides in among these silk screens, these rustling appurtenances. I breathe, and the mouth veil stirs its curtain. My eye veil is a concatenation of rainbows. I am his. Even in his absence, I revolve in my sheath of impossibles, priceless and quiet, among these parakeets, macaws. Oh, chatterers, attendants of the eyelash, I shall unloose one feather like the peacock. Attendants of the lip, I shall unloose one note, shattering the chandelier of air that all day plies its crystals, a million ignorants. Attendants of the nose, the bowsprits of the Viking wallow and dull. Attendants, attendants, and at his next step, I shall unloose from the small jeweled doll he guards like a heart, the lioness, the shriek in the bath, the cloak of holes. A birthday present. What is this behind this veil? Is it ugly? Is it beautiful? It is shimmering. Has it breasts? Has it edges? I'm sure it is unique. I'm sure it is just what I want. When I am quiet at my cooking, I feel it looking. I feel it thinking. Is this the one I am to appear for? Is this the elect one? The one with black eye pits and a scar? Measuring the flour, cutting off the surplus, adhering to rules, to rules, to rules. Is this the one for the Annunciation? My God, what a laugh. But it shimmers, it does not stop, and I think it wants me. I would not mind if it was bones or a pearl button. I do not want much of a present anyway this year. After all, I'm alive only by accident. I would have killed myself gladly that time any possible way. Now there are these veils shimmering like curtains, the diaphanous satins of a January window, white as baby's bedding and glittering with dead breath. Oh, ivory, it must be a tusk there, a ghost column. Can you not see I do not mind what it is? Can you not give it to me? Do not be ashamed. I do not mind if it is small. Do not be mean. I am ready for enormity. Let us sit down to it, one on either side, admiring the gleam, the glaze, the mirrory variety of it. Let us eat our last supper at it like a hospital plate. I know why you will not give it to me. You are terrified. The world will go up in a shriek and your head with it. Bossed, brazen, an antique shield, a marvel to your great-grandchildren. Do not be afraid. It is not so. I will only take it and go aside quietly. You will not even hear me opening it. No paper crackle, no falling ribbons, no scream at the end. I do not think you credit me with this discretion. If you only knew how the veils were killing my days. To you they are only transparencies, clear air. But my God, the clouds are like cotton, armies of them, they're carbon monoxide. Sweetly, sweetly I breathe in, filling my veins with invisibles, with a million probable motes that life. You were silver-suited for the occasion. Oh, adding machine, is it impossible for you to let something go and have it go whole? Must you stamp each piece in purple? Must you kill what you can? There is this one thing I want today, and only you can give it to me. It stands at my window big as the sky. It breathes from my sheets, the cold, dead center where spilled lives congeal and stiffen to history. Let it not come by the mail, finger by finger. Let it not come by word of mouth. I should be 60 by the time the whole of it was delivered and too numb to use it. Only let down the veil, the veil, the veil. If it were death, I would admire the deep gravity of it, its timeless eyes. I would know you were serious. There would be a nobility then. There would be a birthday. And the knife not carve, but enter, pure and clean as the cry of a baby, and the universe slide from my side. Amnesiac. No use whistling for lioness. Sea cold, it certainly is. Take a look at the white high berg of his forehead. There's where it sunk. The blue, green, gray, indeterminate gilt sea of his eyes washing over it, and a round bubble popping upward from the mouths of bells, people, and cows. The Lyonians had always thought heaven would be something else, but with the same faces, the same places, the same shells on the same mantle, next to the same pot dog, the same clock. It was not a shock. The clear, green, quite breathable atmosphere, gold grits underfoot, and the spidery water dazzle on field and street. It never occurred that they had been forgot, that the big god had lazily closed one eye and let them slip over the English cliff and under so much history. They did not see him smile, turn like an animal in his cage of ether, his cage of stars. He'd had so many wars. The white gape of his mind was the real tabula rasa. No use, no use now begging, recognize. There is nothing to do with such a beautiful blank but smooth it. Name, house, car keys, the little toy wife erased. Sigh, sigh. Four babies and a cocker. Nurses the size of worms and a minute doctor tuck him in. Old happenings peel from his skin. Down the drain with all of it. Hugging his pillow like the red-headed sister he never dared to touch, he dreams of a new one, barren, the lot are barren, and of another color. How they'll travel, 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 scenery sparking off their brother-sister rears a comet tail, and money the sperm fluid of it all. One nurse brings in a green drink, one a blue. They rise on either side of him like stars. The two drinks flame and foam. Oh, sister, mother, wife, sweet Lethe is my life. I am never, never, never coming home. Daddy. You do not do, you do not do, any more black shoe in which I have lived like a foot. For 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or hachoo. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time, marble heavy, a bag full of God, ghastly statue with one grey toe big as a Frisco seal, and a head in the freakish Atlantic, where it pours bean green over blue in the waters off beautiful Nauset. I used to pray to recover you, ach du, in the German tongue in the Polish town, scraped flat by the roller of wars, wars, wars. But the name of the town is common. My Polack friend says there are a dozen or two. So I never could tell where you put your foot, your root. I never could talk to you. The tongue stuck in my jaw. It's stuck in a barbed wire snare. Ich, 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 ich. I could hardly speak. I thought every German was you. And the language obscene, an engine, chuffing me off like a Jew to Dachau, Auschwitz, Belsen. I began to talk like a Jew. I think I may well be a Jew. The snows of the Tyrol, the clear beer of Vienna, are not very pure or true. With my gypsy ancestress and my weird luck, and my Tarok pack and my Tarok pack, I may be a bit of a Jew. I have always been scared of you, with your Luftwaffe, your gobbledygoo, and your neat moustache and your Aryan eye, bright blue. Panzerman, Panzerman, oh you, not God but a swastika, so black no sky could squeak through. Every woman adores a fascist, the boot in the face, the brute, brute heart of a brute like you. You stand at the blackboard, Daddy, in the picture I have of you, a cleft in your chin instead of your foot. But no less a devil for that, no, not any less the black man who bit my pretty red heart in two. I was 10 when they buried you. At 20 I tried to die and get back, back, back to you. I thought even the bones would do. But they pulled me out of the sack, and they stuck me together with glue. And then I knew what to do. I made a model of you, a man in black with a Mein Kampf look and a love of the rack and the screw, and I said, I do, I do. So, Daddy, I'm finally through. The black telephone's off at the root. The voices just can't worm through. If I've killed one man, I've killed two. The vampire who said he was you and drank my blood for a year. 7 years, if you want to know. Daddy, you can lie back now. There's a stake in your fat black heart, and the villagers never liked you. They are dancing and stamping on you. They always knew it was you. Daddy, Daddy, you bastard, I'm through. Fever, 103. Pure, what does it mean? The tongues of hell are dull, dull as the triple tongues of dull fat Cerberus who wheezes at the gate. Incapable of licking clean the ague tendon, the sin, the sin. Oh, Otto da Fe, the purple men gold-crusted, thick with spleen, sit with their hooks and crooks and stoke the light. The tinder cries, the indelible smell of a snuffed candle. Love, love, the low smokes roll from me like Isadora's scarves. I'm in a fright one scarf will catch an anchor in the wheel. Such yellow sullen smokes make their own element. They will not rise, but trundle round the globe, choking the aged and the meek, the weak hothouse baby in its crib, the ghastly orchid hanging its hanging garden in the air. Devilish leopard, radiation turned it white and killed it in an hour. Greasing the bodies of adulterers like Hiroshima ash and eating in the sin, the sin. Darling, all night I have been flickering, off, on, off, on. The sheets grow heavy as a lecher's kiss. 3 days, 3 nights. Lemon water, chicken water, water make me rich. I am too pure for you or anyone. Your body hurts me as the world hurts God. I am a lantern. My head a moon of Japanese paper, my gold-beaten skin infinitely delicate and infinitely expensive. Does not my heat astound you, and my light? All by myself I am a huge camellia, glowing and coming and going, flush on flush. I think I am going up, I think I may rise. The beads of hot metal fly, and I, love, I am a pure acetylene virgin, attended by roses, by kisses, by cherubim, by whatever these pink things mean. Not you, nor him, nor him, nor him. Myself's dissolving, old whore petticoats, to paradise.